We'll kick off the new year in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the studios of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with this rain report. This week we bring you a first on the rain report. Over the last 2 weeks, we heard an interview Rains Hapali, KC9RB, conducted in 1987 with Fullerton, California ham April Mel, WA6OPS, talking about the North Pole Network. This week we'll hear from her once again, but this time from a 2014 interview of April conducted by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for his QSO Today podcast. Here's Eric to introduce the first of two excerpts from that interview.
I stumbled upon an article on the internet about how hams very effectively help hospitals that have communications blackouts when their telephone or PBX systems fail due to maintenance or power failures. I never really gave it a second thought until I read about what our guest did in her community to organize local hams to provide this critical communication. For over 30 years, April and her group continue to provide this important public service. When and how did you become involved in amateur radio?
Well, I kind of married into it. I didn't even know amateur radio existed until I started dating my husband, K0OV. We were both in college at the time. Actually, on one of our dates there in Nebraska, he drove me out into a cornfield, believe it or not, where he worked at a country western station, working his way through school, and he had 40 meters. He had a little rig that he had with the vehicle. There we were on a date in the gravel parking lot of this radio station. We were actually listening to 40 meters. That was the first acquaintance with amateur radio, and I thought it was a pretty neat hobby for him. He was very smart. He was in engineering, and I thought that was a nice hobby for him. And a couple of years later, we got married, came to California. He put some equipment in the second bedroom and an antenna on the roof, and it was a nice hobby for him. But it wasn't until a couple of years later, almost 7 years of being married, where I started getting a little frustrated because he had a timer on the radio in the shack in our house at that point. And that was so I could hear him on the radio when he was coming home from work. And then I started realizing, gosh, if I needed something or wanted something, I don't even know what to do. I can't even pick up the radio and ask for it. And then, of course, having been through a little shake and bake here in California with some earthquakes, I also realized, oh, great, I've got all this equipment here. What would happen if we had an earthquake right now and it was really bad? I can't help anybody else, much less myself. So that started me thinking about wanting to get into the hobby. And then what really topped it off was one night we were out coming home after dinner on a Saturday night, and he had the radio on in the car, and I was hearing people giving bearings, 130 degrees this and so forth. And I'm going, what are they doing? And Joe said, well, they're on a transmitter hunt. I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, somebody's hiding with a radio and they're trying to find it. That intrigued me. That sounded like a lot of fun. That's something we could do like together. And he said, oh yeah, most folks hunt as teams, you know. I thought, well, wow. That, on top of being afraid of emergency, not being able to talk to him on the radio, that finally was the impetus to try to get into it. I actually went through Fullerton College. They actually had a 6-week course where you could get an amateur radio license. I used Joe as my mentor. And that's kind of how I got into it at that point.
What year was this?
About 1975, and I finally got licensed in 1976.
Do you remember what your first rig was?
Drake TR-33C was my very first rig, and I thought that was cool. You know, it was the size of a grape nuts box, and it had a shoulder strap. That, I thought, was really great stuff to be able to slung over my shoulder, and I could walk around with that. And I actually kept that at the hospital with me when I worked at St. Jude in Fullerton at the time. I had that with me all the time.
That was like the size of a little mobile radio now with a battery pack in it. It was kind of a luggy talkie on 2 meters.
That's right.
So therefore, your favorite operating mode is and has been VHF FM?
It's the one I'm on the most. If I had my druthers, I suppose I'd do a little more HF because I do enjoy 10 and 15 meters. It just seems that I never get a chance to do that because I'm always busy doing something with the disaster group, and things are on VHF and UHF most of the time. So I'm on some net or I'm coordinating some drill or whatever. So what I'm doing the most, yes, is VHF, UHF, FM. But I like the T-hunting and I like HF when I get a chance to do it. and I enjoy our disaster group folks, so it's nice to be able to talk to them on the air.
Since you've been involved in ham radio for almost 40 years, does it play a role in your family life?
It is our family life. I tease sometimes about how it's not a hobby anymore. It's a lifestyle. Joe and I are both in it, and we're both equally involved. A lot of couples, the husband and wife, are both hams, but it's one of them that's the primary ham, and the other one kind of goes along with them type thing. We're somewhat unique in the sense that we each have gotten very involved in the hobby. We each have sort of our own identities, Joe with ARDF, Tianing, and me with the hospital communications. Then we have our coupleness. It's a lot of the things we do together. I help Joe with the ARDF stuff, and he helps me with the hospital group things. We have one whole room in the house that's all amateur radio stuff. As I said, it's as much a lifestyle now as anything. It's not just a hobby anymore.
Do you have children, and did they become hams?
We do not have children. But we do have B1RD in the other room, our cockatoo. He knows a lot of the disaster group members. His name is Romeo. They hear him in the background a lot of times when we're on our Tuesday night nets, or sometimes even during drills. He'll hear the activity in here, and he wants to be a part of it. And he knows a couple of the members very well by their voices, and he talks to them when I'm on the phone with them, and then he thinks he has to be on the phone with them too. Some of our parakeets over the years have actually imitated the Morse code ideas on the repeaters, which was pretty funny.
So what is the Hospital Disaster Support Communication System, or HDSCS for short, and how did it begin?
Let me tell you with how it began. I was working at St. Jude Hospital in Fullerton. I'd been licensed not quite 3 years at the time. I'd always thought of emergency communications being my radio, and I had my amateur radio emergency service card. And we'd been through a little introductory course at Red Cross, so it was sort of like in my head, I had what I needed to do if there was an emergency. Well, lo and behold, one day in my area of the hospital, I worked in rehabilitation, physical disabilities and rehabilitation, and all the therapies were in the basement. Lo and behold, we didn't have any phones. I was a department head at that point, and people were coming to me and saying, April, we don't have any phones. We don't have any phones. So I thought there was something maybe just local to our area of the basement. I started to walk up the hall to go to respiratory therapy and check with them, and started seeing other people coming out of their various areas going, do you have phones? Do you have phones? Then I realized we might have something serious going on here, and it was like, oh my gosh, I've got my radio. So I went to my office, grabbed that TR-33C. I had to go two wings over to get to where the PBX was, and that was also up a floor above where we were. I felt like the Pied Piper because I was collecting people along the way who were following me from different departments to go up to the PBX to find out what was wrong. When I get up there, I'm asking them what's happening, and they're saying, we don't have any phones. We have nothing. I'm thinking, now what do I do? And I realized that ARES card didn't do a whole lot for me because I didn't really know what I was supposed to do. Here I was in an emergency. So I decided, well, there is a repeater, the ARES repeater that the Red Cross used. I got my Drake TR-33C, went out front of the hospital, jumped up on that repeater, and made a call for help. And lo and behold, there was a member of the Anaheim Radio Club, and that was their repeater, who came up, and he knew me, fortunately. What's happening, April? And I said, I'm out front of the hospital. And I said, we don't have any phones. And he said, goodness, okay, I'm going to try to get you some help. Well, lo and behold, over about the next 30, 45 minutes, people started showing up out front of the hospital. And of course, also by that time, I'd been indoors briefly to talk to the hospital administrator to let them know what I was doing. People started showing up. A few people I knew, but there were also a number of people I'd never even seen before. Some people had a lot of stuff with them. Some people had very little with them, just the radio they were carrying. And one guy came with a whole suitcase. Fortunately, the phone outage only lasted about 2 hours. And during that 2 hours, people had been coming, and with help from the house supervisor, the head nursing person in charge of the hospital during the day. And she was helping decide where people would go.
You're listening to an interview with April Mell, WA6OPS, whose efforts have connected more than 30 Southern California hospitals into the Hospital Disaster Support Communications System, otherwise known as HDSCS. We'll resume Eric Guth, 4Z1UG's 2014 interview with April for his QSO Today podcast in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available on demand on therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Fortunately, as I said, it was over in about 2.5 hours. And during that time, there were some good and bad things that happened from my view. Fortunately, it wasn't obvious to our hospital people is that somebody's batteries failed shortly after they got on assignment. But that was right around the time things ended. And there were clearly people that were unfamiliar with what to do in the hospital setting. So while I was thrilled that these people came and the hospital administration and nursing people were, wow, April, this was neat, I was a little concerned because I'm thinking, wow, we had these people here, but some of them, I have no idea who they are. Some people had good preparation, some people didn't. So that was twirling around in my brain. Clearly, this was a good thing, but somehow it needed to be better than that. The next day when I'm in my office, suddenly the charge nurse from the emergency department comes in and plops down in the chair and says, April, we have to talk. And I said, yes. And she said, I'm the head of the disaster committee for the hospital. I said, okay, I want to know more about these radios. I want to know more about these people that showed up. We have to find a way to get this into the disaster plan. And it was like, now what do I do? So it was basically we were learning from the ground up because there really wasn't much out there when you talk about the end of 1979. Yes, there were stories about HAMS helping in various emergencies, but there was nothing other than sort of the overall ARES umbrella. There was nothing that said how you really put all of this together. And the ARES structure in Orange County, I talked to our EC at the time and I said, what happens in the disaster? And he said, oh, well, we'll go to St. Jude. I said, but they don't know about you. So it was like the HAMS were planning things, but the agencies that they were talking about going to, other than Red Cross, didn't know who they were. And I thought, well, that's not good because we're protective of our patients and we don't want just anybody coming into the hospital. They might be perfectly good people to help, but if the hospital doesn't know who they are, they might not let them in. And of course, people came in that day because the hospital people knew me. And so their assumption was I knew who all these people were. So that really led me into getting together with the local leadership and talking about how we need to make this into a group where we can do some training and special preparation for what it's like to come into the hospital. And then I immediately got appointed as an assistant emergency coordinator. We started really literally from the ground up supporting St. Jude Hospital. I then was asked to come to one of the disaster meetings that other hospitals were at. That same charge nurse who was the disaster committee chair for our hospital, she was chairing that overall group. There were like 7 other hospitals that were part of that group. And she says, now I want you to talk about what you did. And I want you to talk about how you can help the hospital. And of course, I'd been well vaccinated in ham radio. PR is important. So talk about it any chance you can. So this was my opportunity. Of course, I didn't realize that I did too good of a sell job. When that meeting was over, every one of those hospital coordinators that was at that meeting were coming to me and saying, April, how do we do this for our hospital?
This was even before you had created a plan for your organization.
Exactly. It was that incident that moved us very rapidly into that. And we had to find a way because the other hospitals were going, we don't have an April at our hospital. How do we do this? We were trying to figure out how do we find ways. How do these hospitals alert us and so forth if they have a problem? And over time, we ended up with what we referred to as the call-up system that we had in each hospital that we support. And of course, now we support 34 hospitals. And that changes sometimes monthly, sometimes yearly, because hospitals are buying and selling, closing, reopening. But at the moment, we have 34 medical facilities that we support. And that does include all of the acute receiving hospitals. Those are all of the paramedic receiving hospitals in the county. And every one of those facilities came to us and said, we want amateur radio in our disaster plan. We want HDSCS to help us, to support us. So we have a call-up system that each hospital has, and it's unique to their hospital. And it gives 4 names for daytime, weekdays, 4 names for evening and weekends. Those are initial contact people. Those aren't necessarily the people that respond. That might be a responder, but they know how to contact those individuals. Say they called me right now and my phone's busy. They go to the next person on the list and they call that person. They get their phone machine. They call the third person. He's there. He takes the message from the hospital as to what the emergency is. And now the ball is in our court. That ham then activates the system. If he or she is not a coordinator, they contact one of the coordinators, and we activate our members to go to that hospital. So you have to have an activation plan, not only for how does the hospital get a hold of the hams, but how do the hams activate one another. And what we've learned over time is that in order to have a good response to the hospitals, we have to know who's generally available at that time of day in that area. Orange County is pretty big. We don't want to be calling somebody from South County down in Mission Viejo for a hospital emergency that's up in Fullerton. Not to be an initial responder, it's going to take too long. So we actually have what we call first wave sheets that our coordinators and our what we've developed as our select call people. They're the ones that are likely to get a call from a hospital. And it's basically my brains spilled out on paper these days because I know everybody's situation in terms of where they live, where they work, when they tend to be available. So if somebody gets that call from the hospital and they have to help activate, they go to that first wave sheet and it says, oh, for St. Jude, these are the people I should call first. And those are going to be people who live or work at that particular time of day somewhere in the north end of the county, somewhere near Fullerton. And they're going to be relatively available in terms of they can leave work or they can leave home. There's at least six names on that first wave. If we don't get the number of people we need in that first wave, there is a second wave. Once we've used that up, then everybody's fair game in the group. But I can't think of a time where that's happened yet, because usually initial response into one of the hospitals for a single hospital incident is going to be 3 to maybe 6 people max, depending on the size of the hospital and what we're hearing in that initial activation by a hospital. In addition to that, we also have on that call-up sheet a pager number that the hospital can use. And each and every one of the facilities that we support, along with a couple of ambulance companies and County Emergency Medical Services, has their own unique 3-digit code. So we tell the hospitals, if you can't get a hold of us on the landline, can't talk to somebody in person, or if something is so urgent, like you're getting ready to evacuate your facility because of a fire or something like that, some kind of evacuation, you don't want to waste time trying to call people. Just dial up that pager and put in your 3-digit code. That is like magic. If they try to put in their cell phone number or something like that, and we tried to call that, it would likely be busy because they're calling somebody else. Or if their lines are intermittent and we try to call the number they've put in, which might be one of their hospital phones, it might be down. And you know what? We're dead in the water because we don't know what that phone number necessarily matches up with. All we know is we can't get through. But if we get the 3-digit number, that lines up with a specific hospital or EMS, we at least know who's in trouble and we can head out. We can still try to call as well, but that 3-digit number has been crucial on a couple of occasions, because if we hadn't gotten that, we might not have gotten to the hospital in as timely a manner, or not at all. Now, some people say, well, what happens if there's no phones? Usually, if there's no phones at all, that's going to be some kind of area-wide situation. That's what we've referred to as a core team response, and that's our automatic response. Now, we don't encourage any group or any individual ham to just go off and respond to a hospital, unless they're part of already an organized group and they're already part of a plan. That's the issue here with our hospitals, is we're in that plan. They know that we might come and check on them in a major incident. In fact, they want that. If they don't need us, they'll tell us when we get there, and then we can go someplace else that might need us. But if the earth shakes, if we determine that there's a power outage in a particular area and we try to call a hospital, we can't get through, you know what? We go and we check on them.
And that concludes our first of two excerpts from a 2014 QSO Today interview with April Mell, WA6OPS, the driving force behind HDSCS, the Hospital Disaster Support Communication System in Southern California. Is there really a need for this amateur radio program with cell phones being so prevalent these days? April will address that question and more next time when we conclude Eric Guth 4Z1UG's interview with this Fullerton, California ham radio disaster administrator. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2017 Rain. All rights are reserved. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes. Keep on hamming!